The House Human Service Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum, so Representative Norris would like to move the approval of the meeting minutes from March 4th, 2025. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, Representative Norris renews this motion to approve the minutes from March 4th, 2025. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion is approved, and the minutes from March 4th, 2025 are approved. First on the agenda for this morning is an agency overview from the Department of Children's, Youth, and Families. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your presentation.
All right. Thank you so much. Good morning, Chair Schumacher and members of the Human Service Finance and Policy Committee. I'm Tiki Brown, the Commissioner of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. I'm happy to be with you here today to provide an overview of the creation of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, or DCYF. Provide the agency's vision, the programs that have been or will be transferred over to our agency, our leadership and organizational structure, and additional details about the transfer of the DHS Office of Inspector General functions that will move over in June of this year. I'm going to start my presentation with some basic information about the recent establishment of the department. On July 1st, 2024, Minnesota launched the new state agency to create a sustainable public face for children's issues in state government. We are focused on achieving aligned outcomes and policy, improving the front door for services, easing access and navigation for families, and improving services overall. The previous decentralized structure reduced the state's ability to focus on children and families. It's exciting to have a new state agency breaking down these silos, and we're looking across our services and our resources that are available to ensure that Minnesotans are getting all that they need. We are investing in the vision and mission that Minnesota is a state where all children can and do thrive. Thriving families are a cornerstone of a strong Minnesota. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families helps children, youth, and families connect to benefits and resources in order to thrive. The demand, the need, and the request for services come from families all across the state. Our goal is to address these needs, including finding pathways to address the gaps in services faced by families in all 87 counties and 11 sovereign tribal nations in Minnesota. Our state depends on the success of Minnesota's children, youth, and families. The department was established to ensure that children are at the center of government, and the development and implementation plan for the agency included significant community engagement. And as we finish our implementation process, we will expand upon these efforts to ensure that we are serving children, youth, and families in the best way possible. We will use a whole family systems framework in our programs and services, meaning that we will approach our practice, our program, and policy decision making in a way that recognizes and addresses the needs of children and the adults in their lives simultaneously. This is a brief snapshot on the slide number six, which just shows the breadth and depth of programs and populations that the agency serves across the state. And so as you can see, our programs touch hundreds of thousands of Minnesota families, helping ensure that they receive the support they need from our state. This is a lot of words on this slide, but in essence, when the department is fully implemented, it will include programs from four different agencies. From the Department of Human Services, we'll have Children and Family Services programs and related Office of Inspector General programs. From the Department of Education, programs from the Office of Teaching and Learning. And from the Department of Public Safety, programs related to youth justice. And then from the Department of Health, the Help Me Connect program. And I'll provide a little bit more information about each administration a little further down. This slide on page 8 is our agency program transfer timeline. So we started in July 2024 with the early learning services from the Department of Education, some central operating functions, and the Children and Family Services from the Department of Human Services. Some of those central operating functions included communications, human resources, the budget analysis division, and government relations. In October of 2024, we had additional operating functions such as grants and contracts, compliance, and the Human Services Performance Management Council, those staff and programs transferred. In January, we welcomed in Help Me Connect program staff from the Department of Health, along with additional central operations staff working on business integration functions from DHS. And then finally, in June of this year, we will welcome in functions from the DHS Office of Inspector General, the Youth Justice Office of Restorative Practices programs from DPS, and then the final group of central operating functions from the Department of Human Services. I'll make one note that in accordance with the DCYF implementation statutes, the after-school community grant program will transfer only if additional funding is appropriated. Right now, that program's grants are funded through federal fiscal year or state fiscal year 2027. So for your reference, this slide shows our executive team that makes up the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. All positions have been filled at this time except for the Deputy Commissioner. Our new Inspector General, Randy Keyes, joined the agency a few weeks ago and is embedded at the DHS Office of Inspector General in a knowledge transfer role until June. The agency is also in the process of hiring a Children's Mental Health Services Manager and a Children's Disability Services Manager. These positions will provide leadership and coordination of programs to ensure that the agency is working hand in hand with other state agencies to understand and address the needs of children with mental health concerns, children with disabilities, and their families. On slide 10 is a brief overview of our organizational chart, which shows our executive leadership team functions with the policy administrations. So we have four different administrations where our DCYF programs are organized. And I'll walk through this very briefly in the next few slides. So the Child Safety and Permanency Administration is led by Assistant Commissioner Rebecca St. George, who just prior to joining DCYF served as the Legal and Policy Counsel for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe and the Duluth City Attorney. This administration is responsible for Minnesota's child welfare system, and you can see the depth and breadth there. They also support develop and implement state laws, policies, and best practices to help better support better outcomes for children and families at risk of entering or are in the child protection system. This unit also works with the University of Minnesota Twin Cities to provide foundational and other training for the Minnesota child welfare workforce. And with the Tribal Training and Certification Partnership affiliated with the University of Minnesota Duluth, they also provide education and training to new and ongoing child welfare workers, specifically on ICWA, MIFBA, and how to engage with American Indian children and families. Slide 12 is our Early Childhood Administration, which is led by Assistant Commissioner Diane Halsey. Diane Halsey most recently served as the President and CEO of the Family Partnership. This administration oversees programs that support early child care and education, with a focus on increasing access and supporting high-quality early education opportunities, as well as the early learning workforce. The goal of this administration is to support our youngest Minnesotans as they grow and develop. Slide 13 highlights our Economic Opportunity and Youth Services programs, which is led by Assistant Commissioner Kate Weeks, who most recently served as the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs at the Department of Public Safety. This administration combines the Office of Economic Opportunity from the Department of Human Services with the Youth Justice Programs from the Department of Public Safety. The Office of Economic Opportunity administers anti-poverty programs through a network of community action agencies and nonprofit organizations. And some of the core programs include Community Action, Food and Nutrition, and FAME, the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota program. And then the Youth Justice Programs transferring from the Department of Public Safety are intended to enhance the welfare of Minnesota's youth and broaden their opportunities for a better future. Our final administration is the Family Well-Being Administration, which is led by Assistant Commissioner Dr. Shanine Moore. Dr. Moore comes from the Department of Human Services, where she previously served as the Director of the Child Support Division and as a Deputy Commissioner of Children and Family Services. This administration includes programs that are part of Minnesota's critical social safety net for children and families by providing food assistance, cash assistance, child support services, and employment services. This ends my agency overview presentation, and I'll pass along my presenting duties to my colleague, Ashley.
Welcome to the committee. When you're ready, please state your name for the record and continue the presentation.
Good morning. I'm Ashley Reisenauer. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and talking through our agency budget. So programs and functions are continuing to transfer to DCYF throughout state fiscal year 2025. The transition year accounting structure is one tool that's given DCYF that flexibility this year. With feedback from our partner agencies, during this transition year, DCYF is continuing to use accounting structures in the originating agencies, so the Department of Education, Department of Health, and Department of Human Services. Even though funding remains in existing accounting structures, DCYF leadership maintains spending and priorities. We have interagency agreements and approval structures within financial systems that we use to manage day-to-day operations. Beginning July 1, 2025, budgets will be set up within new DCYF accounting structures. This slide shows an overview of DCYF's total budget. Our expenditures are projected to be about $3.7 billion per year. So while we are a new state agency, we are not small. We are actually the third largest state agency in terms of our general fund budget. The largest source of our expenditures is federal funding. It makes up about $2.5 billion, or about two-thirds of our budget, and we'll talk a little more about that in the slides. The state general fund makes up about $1 billion of our funding, and the remaining $290 million comes from other funds, such as special revenue funds. In addition to the expenditures shown in the graph, DCYF also oversees about an additional $1 billion in technical and fiduciary funds. So this is primarily the child support program, which is about $640 million a year. While those are funds that they don't belong to the state, they don't necessarily show up in a budget fund balance, they're an important component when we think about the scope of DCYF's responsibility. The DCYF implementation legislation required that programs and resources and a proportional share of operating resources transfer from originating agencies to DCYF. So as a result, over 99.7% of our budget transferred from originating agencies. That includes not only program funds, the staff who administer them and the systems, but also a proportion of central operations, things like finance, HR, and other management services that transferred to DCYF. In addition, you can see from the slide, the 2023 and 2024 legislatures appropriated about $10.7 million for certain leadership positions that all agencies need, things like a CFO and commissioner, and to address other critical operating positions that DCYF needs to support programs and services. Programs and services make up over 90% of DCYF spending, and we do have a large grant portfolio. About $2.4 billion, or just over 60% of our spending, is in grant programs. An important note, and I'll talk more about grants on the next slide, but the largest single program in this bucket of grant spending is food support provided through SNAP. So it's not what often people think of as a traditional grant program, but it accounts for nearly half of this spending. In addition, about $1.1 billion, or 30% of our expenditures, are for forecast programs that provide economic assistance, adoption and kinship assistance, child care support, and early childhood programs. The remaining 7% of expenditures are for program administration and operations. So about half of that, or about 3.5% of our total spending, is for compensation costs. When all programs have fully transitioned, DCYF will have about 900 to 1,000 FTE. About 95% of those staff positions are transferring from originating agencies. In addition, other administrative costs include things like systems, rent, and other operating needs that support program administration. As I mentioned in the last slide, DCYF spends about $2.4 billion per year on grant programs. About one quarter of this is in the state general fund, while federal funds make up about 70% of grant program spending. Food assistance provided through the SNAP program makes up about $1.2 billion, or half of this funding, and is entirely federally funded. Other grant programs at DCYF do things like provide and expand the availability of child care. They fund programs across the child welfare system. They provide economic assistance and poverty reduction and support youth intervention and restorative practices. So this slide shows the total spending in each budget activity, and examples of the programs shown here are the Great Start Compensation Payment Program, which is about $176 million in total base funding in 2026 and supports over 6,000 child care providers. The Early Learning Scholarships provide over 10,000 children between birth and kindergarten services, and that's about $147 million. Grants to county and tribal agencies provide core child welfare services, such as prevention, family preservation, and makes up over $200 million. Economic assistance for low-income families, such as food shelves and the diaper distribution program. Youth services includes things like the youth intervention program that promotes and sustains youth crime prevention and intervention solutions and the restorative practices initiative. Forecast programs in which spending is projected based on enrollment and service costs account for about $1.1 billion in our annual budget. We're just under one-third of that is the state general fund, and 68% is paid for by federal funding. Federal shares do differ among the programs. For example, both the early childhood family education and health and developmental screening programs are entirely state-funded. DCYF oversees five forecast programs, and the slide shows the total projected budget for fiscal year 2026. While I won't walk through the numbers, a little bit of information about them. The MFIP program provides cash and food assistance for low-income families with children and serves about 77,000 people. MFIP Child Care, the second on the list, helps over 6,500 families who use MFIP afford child care while they're engaged in work or education. The North Star program serves over 19,000 children through foster care, adoption assistance, kinship, and relative custody assistance. The Early Childhood Family Education is a program for children birth through kindergarten, their parents, and parents who are expecting children. It promotes learning development for young children with a focus on parent involvement and education. So approximately 17,000 children are served at over 323 school districts across the state. The Health and Developmental Screening Program provides funding to public school districts, Head Start programs, and some clinics to identify possible health or developmental concerns and to link families to resources. So in state fiscal year 2026, nearly 54,000 children are expected to receive a screening through that program. And that ends my portion, and I'll turn it back over to Commissioner Brown.
All right. Thank you, Ashley. So, Chair and members, I'm going to close out today's presentation with information on the transfer of the OIG functions from DHS to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, starting with licensing. As I address these issues, I'll remind you that our Inspector General has not yet transferred over and the programs have not yet transferred over to the Department. However, we are working hard to expand, and I am working hard to expand the depth of my knowledge and expertise because of the importance of this area and the importance of the issues that they cover. So as mentioned previously, we will establish our Office of Inspector General in June of 2025. And the specific functions that will transfer are listed here on the slide. Family child care licensing, child care center licensing, child care center certification, child foster care licensing, and private child placing agency licensing. We anticipate approximately 89 FTE will transfer from the DHS licensing to our Department of Children, Youth, and Families. This slide highlights how licensing of child care centers and family child care providers occurs in Minnesota, with some duties lying with counties and others with the state. I understand that you've received an overview of child care licensing, so I'll leave this for you to read on your own. But the main point is that no changes to the structure of the licensing responsibilities will be made due to the transfer over from DHS over to DCYF. The county agencies have the primary responsibility for licensing and monitoring of child foster care. In addition, there are 22 private child foster care licensing and placement agencies that provide fee-based foster care licensing services. And the OIG is responsible for establishing the licensing standards used by counties and private agencies in their work. And so the transfer of child foster care licensing to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families ensures that we have a good partnership between the licensing unit and then our Child Safety and Permanency Administration's policy staff, which will continue to provide a system that supports children in need of out-of-home placements as well as foster and kinship care providers. The wanted to touch a little bit on the child care revised licensing standards. The revision of these licensing standards will continue over at the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and our new Inspector General will coordinate with the DHS Office of Inspector General to ensure that the transfer is smooth and that there will be continuity in the work that they started. This slide shows the timeline that was established by DHS for revision of the licensing standards. So the Department of Children, Youth, and Families will follow this timeline to ensure that providers and community have multiple opportunities to provide input on the standards as a third and final draft is prepared for legislative consideration next February. During the next few slides, I'll provide information on the transfer of OIG program integrity functions from the Department of Human Services to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Minnesota is a state that is committed to helping people, and we're committed to providing services that improve the lives of Minnesotans. Fraud against public programs is unacceptable. It is not a victimless crime, and it harms the same people that we are trying to help with these services. And so as we're talking about fraud, abuse, and error, we're utilizing some common definitions. Fraud and abuse are intentional and at times criminal behavior. And at times we find errors that are unintentional and not typically criminal. And so a failure to meet licensing requirements alone is not always considered financial fraud or abuse. However, depending on the type, frequency, and number of violations, the failure to meet regulatory requirements may indicate that further investigation is warranted. So as we discussed earlier, the licensing and program integrity functions from the Department of Human Services will transfer over. The program integrity functions that will relate to the Child Care Assistance Program, the Great Start Compensation Support Payment Program, and MFIB and SNAP recipients. The program integrity work for the child care programs include efforts to prevent, detect, and investigate fraud, abuse, and error. And in addition, the Office of Inspector General performs data-informed audits of child care providers who are receiving grants. If an audit reveals that a provider did not qualify for the grant, the OIG is able to recoup that funding. If the audit reveals suspected fraud, the case is referred to law enforcement. And so the OIG supports county and tribal nations that investigate allegations of fraud involving recipients of MFIB and SNAP as well. And here we just wanted to highlight some of the program integrity tools that the Office of Inspector General is able to use as it detects and investigates fraud, abuse, and errors. First, they are able to investigate, conduct investigations that results from tips and data analysis. They do refer suspected fraud to law enforcement partners for criminal investigation and prosecution. And so that includes the BCA, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, for child care provider fraud, and then referrals to counties for SNAP and MFIB recipient fraud. The OIG is able to take administrative action when it finds fraud, abuse, and error, and those tools include warnings, monetary recoveries, fines, payment withholds, suspensions, and terminations. Along with DHS leadership and with our new Inspector General, I'll work closely with those in partnership over the next coming months to ensure that we have a seamless transfer of the program integrity functions and that we are well positioned to address fraud, abuse, and error head on. My team and I look forward to partnering with the Wallace-Flanagan administration, legislature, and other state agencies to ensure that resources are used properly and effectively to support our fellow Minnesotans who need our assistance. I'd like to thank you for having me on our committee and for having Ashley on the committee. I appreciate having the opportunity to share the good work that the department is doing on behalf of Minnesota children and families. And we're happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner Brown and Ms. Reisenauer, for your presentation this morning and for making it here this morning. Are there any questions for the commissioner? Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, thanks for coming. It does seem like this transition is a good thing, you know, to bring all of these services together in kind of a like format. I appreciate everything about your presentation. I honestly didn't hear one thing that raised a red flag of, what are we doing here? In my summer of door knocking, I talked to a lot of daycare providers, some of them home daycare providers, some of them small facility daycare providers, and many of them indicated to me that the regulatory environment starts to get dialed up, making it hard for them to stay open, making it hard for them to provide the same good quality daycare they have provided for many of them 10, 20, and 30 years. And I heard you say there's a feedback process. Even as we go forward, you can receive feedback. And if unintended consequences included making it hard to keep a daycare open in various towns and cities, then maybe that feedback could still impact our policies and maybe dial back the regulation just a tad. Would you please consider what those regulations might be? Because the daycare providers told me a whole bunch of things and I couldn't even take it all in. And then secondly, if they wanted to provide feedback, what would that look like? What is that process? Thank you.
Commissioner Brown.
Thank you so much for your comments and also for that question. And we too have heard a lot of feedback, I think, throughout the modernization process for the regulations. We have been at the Department of Children, Youth, and Families working really closely with the Human Services team that is managing that modernization process to really understand what are the steps that they are taking and what are they hearing, quite frankly. I have received many of the same feedback that you likely have as well. So the process that the team has outlined is a pretty robust community engagement process where they have outlined multiple options for people to provide feedback. The drafting process is designed to continue to reiterate and make adjustments based on that feedback. Looking at my notes here, I believe that some of the early feedback sessions that they've had so far, just at the end of February, had over 400 folks participate in that process. And what we'll make sure happens is that feedback is indeed incorporated in the adjustments. So we have another draft version that will be released before legislation will be posed, and we want to make sure that we're doing that in partnership with folks.
Representative Gander.
Thanks, Commissioner. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I'm really excited to hear this overview. I spent a lot of time with you and your team in Children and Family last year, kind of in the transition. I have three questions. I'll kind of ask one and then give you the opportunity because they're very different. So the first one is around the child care grants that we had implemented. I know, done with great intention, not sure if it's because of the move or just the implementation process in general, but I'm hearing from my community that some of those Great Start grants had a pretty significant delay in getting out to our communities. Can you either address that or let us know, was that the case or is it just the timing process in general that my community needs to get used to? Would just love to hear kind of the feedback on my community is feeling like they're not getting that that money into their community fast enough. And what's happening is then people are having to withdraw their children from childcare because of the lag in these grants. So that's the first question.
Commissioner Brown.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. I appreciate that feedback. That is not something that we have heard, that there's a delay in the Great Start compensation grants. So that's something that we will follow up with. And I don't think we have anybody in the room here that can speak specifically to that. One of our goals in this transition is to ensure that there was continuity in services, that there was no break in services, so we should not have any delay as a result of the transfer of programs or the transfer of services. We have a number of interagency agreements in place, in fact, to ensure that grant contracts continue no matter where they are living from their home agency. So we'll follow up with you, if that's okay, to look into what delays might be occurring and how that's impacting people.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. You're a commissioner that I trust will do that with a team that I know will follow up on this. So, yes, for my community, I would like that. The second question I have is something that I feel like kind of gets lost in the mix because again, we work so much in silos, is youth, human, and sex trafficking. Like when you look at page 18 and all the different departments that feed into DCYF, sex trafficking, particularly our youth sex trafficking and safe harbor work, lands a little bit in all of these components, and I feel like I never really get a clear answer on who kind of owns that area, because there's judiciary, there's public safety, there's health, there's the human service capacity. And so can you give any insight of sort of how we would address some of those areas and who is the commissioner landing spot that's going to take that conversation on?
Commissioner Brown.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. So right now within the department, the one program focus area falls in child safety and permanency with sex trafficking. It's a small component. However, as we've talked about incorporating youth services throughout the agency, it in fact lies across every single program to ensure that we are addressing the needs of youth. quite frankly, I think one of the biggest opportunities in this new department is to raise the profile of services and opportunities for youth. I think it is something that, with the current structure, has gotten lost in some of programming. So with all of my assistant commissioners, we have talked about ways to uplift and raise specific youth-focused programming, and it fits with our whole family systems approach as well. So we have Assistant Commissioner Kate Weeks, who has a background in this, as well as Assistant Commissioner Rebecca St. George, and the two of them have been having some internal conversations about what that might look like as we begin to build out opportunities in the department.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for that. Would really like to be in those conversations when it's ready, because this is something that impacts greater Minnesota at higher rates. We know when we ask our students if they've been asked to exchange sex for any items, it's actually the Northwest area of the state that students are answering at the highest percentage of yes. And that's a problem for me. It should be, I guess, right, a problem for all of us. And I think part of addressing this really big issue is that small components land in different areas and nobody's really taking the lead. And I just think it's something we really need to address. So happy to do that. The last question I have is around SNAP. I feel like you were giving some pretty big numbers and percentages on like how much of the federal grants we have with SNAP. That's major. That's how we feed Minnesota in a really big component. Could you just walk through those numbers? I was trying to write my notes really fast. I know you said it's a large part of our federal grants. I know in the past, there's been reductions in SNAP, which then means it's harder for us to feed Minnesotans. So could you just give me some of those numbers on SNAP again, and any maybe more in-depth information you can share about the reductions we've seen in SNAP over the last couple years, how that's impacted our communities, and anything we maybe need to look at now to build a robust feeding network for Minnesota?
Ms. Reisenauer.
Thanks, Representative Keeler. We serve about 440,000 people on SNAP, and we spend over $1 billion in federal funds on SNAP. I don't have specific information about reductions, though certainly as certain pandemic programs have expired, that's affected the program moving forward.
Commissioner Brown?
If I may, I can jump in a tiny bit here. So in the past, there were reductions in SNAP that were related to populations able to receive SNAP. So if you were a single adult, for example, there have been reductions at the federal level that limit that population in the past who could receive SNAP. And then as Ashley mentioned, there have been pandemic supports that created a lot of opportunity for folks to increase their food budget, which then was reduced as those pandemic supports did in fact go away. We do have a new program, it used to be the pandemic EBT program, now is the summer EBT program, which has helped provide additional supports specifically to children through an EBT card benefit to be utilized in the same way as SNAP, but we are watching really carefully federal policy changes that might impact the SNAP population in Minnesota.
Representative Keeler.
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. This is for the commissioner. I would just love to just dive into the CCAP licensing transition process a little bit more. So I'd love to know steps that you're taking, the fraud prevention piece of it, as you're transitioning over. What does that look like? It's on page 23, I think, is a few steps. So I just want to know what you're doing in the process so there will be a seamless transfer of that happening.
Commissioner Brown.
Sure.
Chair and Representative, thank you so much for the question. So as part of the transition, some of the steps that we take with each of the home agencies and the program areas, we look really carefully at the services that they are providing and the staff that are providing those services. And so what we have done so far is really worked with the Department of Human Services Inspector General team to really get a clear understanding of the staff that are assigned to each of these programs. And then as they transfer over, what we're working towards with the new Inspector General, who I think is maybe on week two, maybe three, so we're still early in this conversation before they transfer over in June, is really looking to see how might we strengthen the coordination between the program areas and how might we strengthen within our operational functions and provides additional support to the team as they transfer over. So as each transfer, we provide some orientation, we welcome them in, we orient them to the department structure, and then we work to ensure that we aren't recreating silos. We have a pretty strong focus on ensuring that we're building a culture that is DCYF unique, because we have so many different agencies coming in from so many different areas. It's really important to us that we break down those silos and ensure that we have some coordination. So that's our first portion of work that we're doing, and as we get a little closer, we'll get into much more of the details around ensuring that their technology supports are in place and some of those more nitty-gritties.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I did hear you say as well, Commissioner, that for the OIG, you're going to need 89 FTEs. And I know that there's other areas. I think to prop up the DCYF, we learned a couple weeks ago that there's 682 new FTEs that are going to be needed for this program overall. I don't know if you've heard that number or not, but that's what we had gotten that report from DHS, that there were 682 new FTEs needed. My question is how many FTEs are going to transfer over from DHS versus new hires?
Commissioner Brown.
That's one.
Thank you for that question. So 89 FTE will transfer over specifically with the licensing functions. No new hires in this space from the Department of Human Services, or from Department of Children, Youth, and Families.
Representative Gilman.
Okay, great. So, Commissioner, also, I imagine you've heard of the story in Plymouth that the maltreatment that was happening at the Child Care Center. Curious if the OIG department, or what are the steps that are going to be taken to help reduce not only fraud, but maltreatment of our kids in the state of Minnesota?
Commissioner Brown.
Thank you, Representative and Chair. So maltreatment investigations for family child care providers and child foster care are conducted by counties, and then the state handles maltreatment investigations for the child care centers and certified centers. And so the Office of Inspector General, so that's sort of the separation. I'm going to say that one more time. So maltreatment investigations for family child care providers and child foster care are conducted by the counties. And the Office of Inspector General that will be transferring over to DCYF handles the maltreatment investigations for child care centers and certified centers. And so I don't have any specifics in terms of, you know, the numbers of cases that they have at this point, but we can certainly follow up with additional details. My level of information that I have is limited to that at this point.
Representative Gilman.
So just to follow up on that, thank you, Chair. And thank you, Commissioner. How can we ensure, and I'll look at the child care centers, and that's part of DHS currently, which is going to be DCYF. How are we going to ensure that there's going to be extra measures of protection for our kids? Because there's a difference. There's 1791 licensed centers, and then the counties are handling, you know, almost 5,800 licensed providers. So I'm curious, like, there is a separation, but how are we going to ensure we're not repeating some of the same things? Because there's reports made all the time of maltreatment, fraud, suspected fraud. And as these investigations are happening, you know, we've heard from the assistant commissioner, who's now our acting commissioner in DHS, that it's extreme to be able to pump the brakes on payments and things like that. But I want to make sure kids are safe, because when we see aired the things that are happening under the current way that we have it set up, I didn't want to ensure that things would look differently so we would be able to have our kids safe.
Commissioner Brown.
I appreciate that, and I agree. I mean, child safety is the absolute focus that we must have. One of the things that I've had a few conversations with our new Inspector General is how do we ensure that there's coordination and understanding of some of the work that's happening at the county level and with the state folks as well. And so we're interested in ensuring that there's strong alignment there and shared information and resources. I think that's one way that we can really lean on each other who are doing similar but slightly different investigations. I think there's things that we can learn in that space, and we're interested in exploring other ideas that this committee and others might have on ways that we can strengthen these efforts.
Representative Gilman.
All right, thank you so much.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here. My questions have a little bit to do with just the conversations or communication between counties and yourself. And we've heard in some cases we have real problems with just our technology. And I'm wondering if those issues are also present in your work at the agency.
Commissioner Brown.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. Indeed, they are. Unfortunately, we have many outdated older systems. The primary system that we've had the most conversations with counties about in the most recent years is our SSIS system, our Social Services Information System, which is a system that hosts about 30 different programs and services. And so one of the focuses that we've had this year is really honing in on the child welfare portion of SSIS, which has the most complexity and the most instability. And we've been able to partner really closely with our county partners who have provided some excellent demonstrations to us and our IT staff to really demonstrate what they are facing every day as they use that system. So we do have in the governor's budget a request for support for modernizing that system. It will take several years to incorporate all of the 30 programs that are comprised of the SSIS system, but we're confident that if we can get moving and get forward progress, we can begin to make a significant impact. And we also, I will say, recognize, and counties have been very clear with us, that the impact of the older systems that we have really impacts their ability to maintain their workforce and really impacts their ability to provide the very services that we're asking them to do. So we've had a lot of communication, a lot of conversation and coordination in that space.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the answer. Is it possible to fix that like one area at a time, or does it have to be all inclusive, do you think?
Commissioner Brown.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Excellent question. I think earlier iterations had an idea of all-inclusive, and I think we quickly realized the expense and the time required that we actually modernize bit by bit. And that's the path that we are moving forward now. What is the most critical, and while also stabilizing the system so people are able to use it, and then move forward in a very strategic, intentional effort to go bit by bit, block by block, if you will.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would you say that counties perceive as the most important area that if they said, well, this is the area we need to fix first, what would it be?
Commissioner Brown.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. The child welfare component, I think, is the most critical. There are, when we were able to do a, Pine County did a demonstration for us, and they shared with us the wait time that it took to work through the system. And they shared that their child protection workers are spending more time on the computer system than they are actually with families. And that is unacceptable. We need to switch that where they're spending more time with families and less time with the computer system. So that's, I think, the most critical component.
Representative Murphy.
I just have one last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering about the total FTEs. And I just really like to get a handle on how many people work remotely. And so if you had numbers for me on that, that would be helpful. I try to ask that a lot. I want to really know for taxpayers, you know, what it looks like in the agencies.
Sure. Commissioner Brown.
Do you want to repeat the total numbers? Do you have that?
So we have a total of about 900 to 1,000 FTE.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I was saying the same number. So the number is not quite final, Chair and Representative, until we complete our final transition. So we have That's why there's that break. We have about 50% of staff that come into the office about once a month. My executive leadership team comes in 2 to 3 times a week, and we have a variety of folks that range from every day to, you know, maybe once a month. We have, as an agency, not put in place a mandate of in the office set times until we are complete with our transfer. I mentioned we are really looking at the culture of the organization and ensuring that as we bring in programs and staff from the variety of different agencies, we recognize that they all have different policies and programs and systems that they are operating. And so when we complete our transfer is when we will put in place a process and a policy around in-office work.
Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the answer.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Brown, and the work your team is doing to make sure that the separation goes smoothly. Just wanted to follow up with Representative Murphy, the question about the systems. I know we've talked a lot about SSIS, but we haven't even talked about MAXs, PERISM, and others who are, you know, all those systems need to be changed soon, not tomorrow, but something that we can start talking about. What's the plan? Because some of the programs within DHS will rely on the same systems. So what's the plan for that separation of systems between DCYF and DHS?
Commissioner Brown.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Indeed, we have a number of systems that do require updates and modernization. So as we have moved through the transition process, we have determined a number of IT systems that will have a home agency and some that will be shared. And so we have determined, based on the services that are provided and the populations provided, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families has ownership over MAXIS, the system that offers SNAP, MFIB, cash assistance, PRISM, which is a system that supports our child support, SSIS. Like I might be missing one more in that mix. So we have devised a system between the agencies. We are working on a shared governance structure so that we can make joint decisions. So for instance, we know that MAXIS still hosts several programs that operate out of Department of Human Services, and in order to really address the needs of MAXIS, we need to do that in a coordinated fashion. So we have a series of meetings and committees that are structured in order to assure that that happens. We are, in addition, working with our commissioner at Minute and our chief business technology officers between DHS, DCYF, and Minute to really lay out a plan for our digital modernization. We have a number of steps that we've taken for PRISM that is leading us to modernization. We know that MAXIS has had a number of efforts over the years that have not gotten us, I think, to the point that we need to. In terms of prioritization, SSIS is the most critical at this point in time, and so we prioritize that and then are working through a prioritization schedule for the remaining systems.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will that also include MEC Square and MEC Square Pro as we see the aging of that system since it was built a few years back?
Commissioner Brown.
Thank you, Representative and Chair. That's the program I forgot. MEC Squared as well. Yes.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that falls on us, most of us who are sitting here, because if we cannot find the funds to modernize those systems, we have failed not only the state but also the counties. So I think if we are really intentional of what needs to be happening, this is the time. If we can find the resources to build those systems that are needed to serve Minnesota. So thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Final question, Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. I was looking for some clarification on the number of children that were helped by the MFIP child care assistance. Did you say 6,500 or?
Ms. Reisenauer.
Thank you for that question. Let me look back in my notes. MFIP serves over 6,500
families. 6,500 families, okay. Do we know how many children that ends up being then, or is it It just seems like an awful lot. I mean, that's $34,000 a year per family. I mean, that's, I could send one of my kids 3.5 years to daycare where we go.
I don't have the exact number right here, but we can give you the number, get you the number of.
Okay. Representative Gordon. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm curious on how many of those dollars are used to just deliver the funds versus how many are actually getting in the hands of families to help pay for that. And I have some major concerns, and I guess that would be a question for you guys as well. As we subsidize these things, I mean, do we have any concern that we're inflating the price for people that aren't getting assistance? Ms. Reisenauer.
Thanks, Chair. The funds that we're talking about are program funds. They are the funds that are used to support children. I think you asked about administration. And it's generally below market price. So I think we're, when the question about inflation, I don't know that it's a driver of inflation for the overall cost of child care across the state.
Representative Gordon. I mean, I have a hard time believing that you would put that much money into something like that and not inflate the price for people that aren't getting the assistance. But that's all I had, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask Commissioner Brown. Are we at 75% at the market rate? Because we're looking at the data. And last year, for the first time, last session is when we went to 75 percentile required by the federal government so that we can continue to provide the child care program.
Commissioner Brown.
Chair and Representative, you are correct. Last year, after much conversation, we were able to move to 75% of the market rate, which is indeed required by the federal government and has been long advocated by child care providers.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're still not at 100%. We're below the market rate, given that we just reached the 75%.
Commissioner Brown.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. You are correct.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure that we get those numbers. And, Mr. Chair, I think if you go to the counties, the specific data, how much the counties pay, it's based on the region and how the market is changing. So you can see exactly hourly rate, weekly rates, and whichever rates that are acceptable in the child care program. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. And with that, the committee thanks you, Commissioner Brown and Ms. Reisenauer, for your presentation this morning.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is House File 1346. Representative Nash, as he's making his way up, I will move that House File 1346 be referred to the General Register. Representative Nash, once you're settled in, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and
good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Nash, District 48A. I'm happy to be here today to talk about House File 1346 with you. This is another of my efforts to begin addressing child abuse in the state of Minnesota. I wanted to thank my my co-author here in the committee, Representative Verning. Thank you for joining my bill. I know I have a lot of other supporters on the bill and in past years as well. Mr. Chair, the gist of 1346 is to begin increasing the amount of specificity in training that mandatory reporters will receive as they go through the training. And you'll see in lines 1.14 through 1.20, it details some of the things that are specific to that training content. It'll show how to find signs of a suspected maltreatment as defined in the section of law mentioned there. And then in lines 1.18, that it will take expert input. And we worked on this bill with DCYF, and they're very open and amenable to this, but wanted to make sure that we were dealing with medical professionals, attorneys, mental health professionals, social workers, and others. And I do have a testifier who apparently wasn't as brave as we were or just smarter than we were and stayed home, but be remoting in. So I think it's Melissa DeBilzen with Safe Passage. I think she's on Zoom, Mr. Chair. I'm not 100% sure.
Yes, she expect that she
I'm
will
here.
Be. All right, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Melissa DeBilzen, and I am the Executive Director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota, which is a nonprofit that is advocating for the safety and well-being of children at risk of maltreatment. We work closely with frontline professionals in the child welfare system. Child abuse is a significant but often overlooked issue in Minnesota. We see this in state data, but it is rarely discussed publicly. In 2022, we know that around 5,000 children were confirmed victims of abuse, and tragically, 21 children lost their lives. If this were a childhood disease, we would be pouring money into treatments and cures. Like a disease, we know that prevention is key, and there are better outcomes for kids when abuse and neglect are detected and mitigated early on. That is where mandated reporters come in. Mandated reporters play a critical role. These teachers, childcare providers, healthcare workers, law enforcement, and social services professionals are often a child's first line of defense. Nearly 80,000 reports of potential maltreatment were made across Minnesota counties in 2022, and 80% of these reports originated from mandated reporters. Robust training for mandated reporters is essential. However, after reviewing the state's mandated reporter training, we were shocked by what was and wasn't being taught. Of the 45-minute training, only 2 to 3 minutes were dedicated to recognizing signs of maltreatment. Additionally, the training misrepresented child protection as potentially harmful to families and included guidance that contradicted state law, such as requiring reporters to be certain of maltreatment rather than having reason to believe. Fortunately, the Child Welfare Training Academy has been open to feedback. To build on their openness for continuous improvement, we strongly support House File 1346, which ensures training meets 2 basic requirements. First, at least half the training must focus on recognizing signs of maltreatment. Daycare workers, for example, may not realize that bruises on infants under 4 months are suspicious. A preschool teacher may not know that bruises on the neck are rare and concerning. A school secretary seeing a child regularly arrive hungry may not know if it's poverty or statutory neglect. A few minutes of training simply is not enough. Signs of maltreatment must be incorporated into mandated reporter training, not treated as an afterthought. Second, the training must be informed by professionals with expertise in child maltreatment. A child abuse pediatrician, for example, is best suited to educate on physical signs of abuse. An attorney ensures legal accuracy. A mental health professional can advise on sensitive questioning. A social worker can provide insight on available resources. This is a simple, common sense bill that can have a profound impact on protecting Minnesota's children. I urge your support to ensure mandated reporters receive comprehensive, expert-informed training to help keep children safe. Thank you for your time and consideration. I am open to any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. DeBilzen, for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1346? Seeing none, public testimony is now closed. Questions for the bill author or his testifier? Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash, for bringing this bill forward. Mm-hmm. This is an important issue for us to really look into. So some of the challenges within the reporting the mandated reporters, there's a difference between what is maltreatment and when there's also a problem whereby we can address a need for an individual. So I'll give you an example. If a child or student comes to school with the same clothing that are dirty, and somehow we see something and we report that, you know, saying that there may be some maltreatment at home, is there a process whereby within this training we may look into the family and provide them the support they need? Maybe the washing machine is broken, just needs to be fixed, and so they need some extra help. Mm-hmm. Will that be included in the training and also provide guidance where they can seek help?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Neuwirth, I think that those are some of the things that the professionalization of the training, where we have different voices of different experts that will be brought into what to recognize and how to see if it's maltreatment or maybe in the example that you give, if it's just a broken washing machine. I think that when we add that higher level of professionalization, we will take a step in the right direction for the children that we're trying to help.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Chair.
Representative Momani Hiltzley.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. My question stems from me representing the most diverse district in the whole entire state of Minnesota. And so I definitely want to make sure that as we are thinking through this, and especially when it comes to training, we keep in mind the cultural context of the different communities that are represented in Minnesota, because I think that's so key, especially coming from, for example, my family comes from Kenya. And so I just want to make sure that the cultural context in terms of training is diverse as well. Thank you. But I think it's a brilliant bill. Thanks.
Brilliant bill author, Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For returning members, you know my story. You know that for 17 years of my life, I was an abused kid. And the most important mandatory reporter in my life, my mom, failed me. So this has created sort of an inflection point for me. And for those who know me, this is very much, again, another not typical Jim Nash bill. These are not the things that Jim Nash, the whip for the Republicans, does. But this is very personal for me. And our children are precious. And we have to do a good job so that we can prevent 5,000 kids from being abused, that we can reduce that number. I knew this was a mistake, but today in committee, we have one of our high school pages that happens to be my daughter, Emily. Because I was able to break the cycle, which is what we're trying to do, my daughter, Emily, has grown up in an abuse-free home. That's what we're trying to do, members. We are trying to make sure that children can grow up never experiencing what I experienced, and that's the gist of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. I would agree with you that often we disagree on many things. This is one of the things that we deeply align. Coming from a community that's rooted in violence, we do need to know the signs. I worked close with you and emotionally with you as we got really good work across the finish line, you know, based on your story last term. Have added my name onto the bill this term because I think the work that you're doing is noble. And I think it's good for us to stand up in the face of violence. And I do really appreciate your work and your voice. Many of us have been trying to have a voice against violence for a very, very, very long time. And I'm glad that this can be something that we partner in, but I'm sad that this continues to happen. And I do think that trainings like this will make a difference. And I think the work that you do will have a lifelong impact, absolutely. Thank you, Representative Nash.
Thank you.
Representative Nash?
Thank you very much for the time. Thanks for the support.
Oh, we have more questions. I just
No. Okay.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Representative Gander.
Oh. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash. Yeah, thank you for bringing this. I can tell it's from the heart, and I'm glad to think of it as being important to all of us on both sides here. I'm just curious, when we think about the training, you know, we have a lot of mandatory reporters who are licensed providers, and I'm just curious if their training could come as part of their formal recertification, like continuing education requirement for dentists, chiropractors, optometrists, medical doctors, or if it would have to come through, let's say, a county agency. Could we reach out to their professional associations and say, by all means, include this year in your education for these licensed providers, this kind of training? Is there any way that that could happen inside of the normal education process?
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gander, that's a great question. And I was talking with DCYF about, and here's an idea, a notion that many don't know, that a mandatory reporter is not required to become a mandatory reporter. So I think that as we begin tightening these things up and begin working on other bills and other things, that is one of the on-ramps that we can look at, is working with the professional agencies or professional organizations like you've just mentioned. But I appreciate the openness of the agency to look at this, because we want to make sure that the people who have access that might be observers of our kids or just people will be able to be equipped. So if you go to the optometrist, or if you go to someone that is providing a service, that if they are a mandatory reporter, that they have been properly trained, and that we work to make it smart and easy for them to be trained through the training academy or wherever they may be trained.
Representative Gander. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, final word, Representative.
Okay. Well, once again, thank you so much for the support. I appreciate the very broad number of voices that have signed up to be on this bill. We have a long way to go, but we're making progress. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you so much.
And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1346 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion passes, and House File 1346 is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Nash.
Thank you.
Next, we will have Representative Clardy with House File 1215. As she makes her way forward, I will move that House File 1215 be laid over for possible inclusion in an upcoming omnibus bill. Representative Clardy, you also have the DE2 amendment. I will move the DE2 amendment to get the bill into the shape you would like to present it. Are there any questions before we vote on the DE2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the DE2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails, and the DE2 amendment is adopted. Representative Clardy, whenever you're ready.
I do have water over there. First of all, Chair and committee members, thank you for taking the time to let me present this important bill, House File 1215. The bill is to reform Section 245D for conditional licensing. And why do we need 245D disability service licensing reform? Well, I'll tell you why. So this committee is named Human Service Committee. So it's probably no surprise that with a complex system like this and humans being involved, that there are going to be mistakes. A very small number of these mistakes are serious and life-threatening concerns and require immediate action by regulators. This bill has no change to that. The vast majority of the mistakes are not complicated in the human service programs. It's mainly paperwork and minor filing, very equivalent to like having brake lights out. We shouldn't bankrupt small businesses and providers by firing employees and declaring emergencies for minor mistakes for paperwork violations. So too often we're seeing conditional license painting with a very broad brush, providing providers, or I'm sorry, punishing providers with a 1 or 2 year penalty box suspension on new admissions, with little opportunity for shortening or erasing the punishment or other type of remedies other than going to court. So this bill is about prioritizing and focusing on obviously limited resources with our regulators at the DHS. So it's more of a collaborative approach, and collaborative safety is a formal method of safety system designed that uses information sharing and organizational transformation methods to correct mistakes in complex systems without blaming humans for their mistakes. But instead, it offers people multiple opportunities for safety and to improve and do corrections. So briefly, to go over what this bill is Section 1 would require the commissioner to give licensing education to license holders with clear, accessible explanations on achieving and maintaining compliance requirements. Section 2 requires initial compliance monitoring within 12 months of new license for technical assistance on how to achieve and maintain compliance and initial licensing review. Section 3 requires the commission to give the providers technical assistance when requesting or referral of legal assistance. Section 4, parts A and B, requires a correction order to conditional licensing orders specific to services sites at which violations occurred, so at the specific sites, and it uses a severe conditional, the use of severe conditional license punishment must not be connected to, or must be connected to the most recent violation. Paragraph C requires the commissioner to warn license holders when subsequent audits and investigations may lead to conditional licensing if they fail to correct their mistakes. Paragraph D allows the commissioner to reduce the length of time for conditional license penalties if the provider demonstrates compliance or progress. Paragraph E requires the commissioner to report to the legislature on the number of the number and locations of corrections and conditional licensing penalties to give lawmakers a better picture of where DHS enforcement occurs. Section 5 requires the commissioner to offer the option of mediation to dispute a commissioner's correction order with the expense of mediation paid by the license holder. And Section 6 is a repeal of some obsolete subdivisions recommended by the Senate Council. And members, I appreciate your support on this bipartisan bill effort, and I do have testifiers, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Clardy, for your presentation. We'll start with Ms. Grafstedom. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom. I'm the Senior Director of State and Federal Policy at ARM. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House File 1215. ARM represents over 200 residential service providers providing services to people through the four disability waivers licensed under 245A and regulated under 245D. Over the last year, we've been grateful for the opportunity to provide feedback and work in partnership on the language in House File 1215. Many of ARM's members have been providing services since the establishment of the waiver in Minnesota. Their staff have years of experience in understanding the rules and regulations that a provider must follow under both 245A and 245D. And even with that experience, members often have questions about the meaning of certain regulations or what they should be doing to make sure they comply with an ever-changing regulatory landscape. Understanding these rules and regulations can be even more challenging for new providers or providers who speak English as a second language. The proposed requirement for licensing compliance education will equip new and existing license holders with clear and accessible resources to understand and maintain compliance with licensing requirements. This proactive approach will not only empower providers, but will foster a culture of transparency and accountability. Additionally, establishing initial compliance monitoring visits will play a pivotal role in supporting new license holders. By providing technical assistance during these visits, the state can help to ensure that providers begin with the necessary tools and guidance needed to successfully comply with licensing standards. Finally, we want to share our support for the establishment of a mediation process when the request for reconsideration of a correction order has been denied. Creating a mediation process gives providers an additional option outside of legal action when they feel like a correction order has been given in error. I want to conclude by saying that this legislation in no way is trying to limit the commissioner's ability to take action on violations. Instead, this legislation develops a system of support for providers to help them understand requirements from the beginning, helping mitigate or eliminate violations from occurring in the first place. Thank you for the time and the opportunity to provide support for House File 1215.
Thank you, Ms. Grafstrom, for your testimony. Next, we have Zania Harut from the Residential Providers Association of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you all able to see me and hear me?
Yes, we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Zania Harut, and I serve as the board chair of the Residential Providers Association of Minnesota, also known as RPAMN. RPAMN is a nonprofit trade association representing small residential customized living and waiver services providers across Minnesota. The majority of our members are culturally specific service providers who deliver essential care to some of the state's most vulnerable populations. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in strong support of House File 1215, which takes critical steps to address licensing fairness and compliance support for home and community-based services providers under 245D. At its core, the bill is about ensuring high-quality care for residents and individuals in the community by improving provider support, clarifying compliance expectations, and making enforcement more consistent and fair. Our goal is not to reduce accountability, but to create a regulatory system that helps providers succeed, because when providers succeed, program participants receive better and more stable care. This bill recognizes the challenges small providers face when navigating complex compliance requirements and proposes reasonable, common sense reforms that improve transparency, accountability, and support for providers. I want to highlight four key provisions of the bill that will have a direct impact on residents' quality of care. Number one, addressing inconsistency of conditional license orders. One of the most pressing concerns among 245D providers is the inconsistent and subjective nature of conditional licensing orders. For example, some providers receive a conditional license for minor paperwork errors, such as missing signatures on documentation, while others who fail to administer medications properly or have no documentation or record of medication administration face no conditional licensing consequences at all. The lack of consistency creates an environment where providers cannot trust the regulatory process, as enforcement appears to be based more on the individual licensor's discretion rather than standardized criteria. These inconsistencies directly impact residents and individuals in the community, as providers who fear arbitrary punitive actions may divert resources away from resident care to excessive documentation efforts rather than focusing on service quality and resident well-being. This bill introduces more predictable and transparent pathways by requiring DHS to issue warnings before a conditional license to allow for corrections, standardize enforcement actions to ensure fair and proportionate consequences, and allow reductions in the duration of the conditional license when providers demonstrate compliance, helping them focus on improving care rather than navigating bureaucracy. So compliance education and initial monitoring. The 245D license has numerous complex requirements with deadlines and instructions spread across multiple sources, making compliance unnecessarily complicated. DHS does provide sample policies, procedures, and forms, but many have not been updated for years, leading to confusion among providers trying to follow outdated guidance. When compliance expectations are unclear or contradictory, it does not improve care. It only makes it harder for providers to meet necessary standards. This bill addresses this by requiring DHS to provide compliance education to help providers proactively meet licensing requirements and conduct an initial compliance monitoring visit within the first 12 months of licensure so that providers receive technical assistance well before punitive actions are taken. Transparency and due process. This bill requires DHS to publish annual reports on correction orders and conditional licenses, ensuring greater transparency in enforcement actions. And the introduction of a mediation as an option for providers who lose the reconsideration request creates a fair process by allowing for an independent review before severe penalties are imposed. In conclusion, the heart of this issue is care for Minnesotans with disabilities. Minnesota's home and community-based service providers are deeply committed to delivering high quality care, but outdated and inconsistent regulatory practices create unnecessary barriers to that mission. For small providers, a conditional license can be devastating, not because they don't want to comply, but because the system lacks clear, standardized pathways to compliance. When enforcement is inconsistent and punitive, it does not improve care. Instead, it strains resources, discourages new providers from entering into the field, and it creates instability for the very people that we're all here to serve. This is a crucial step towards ensuring that licensing supports, not hinders, high-quality care. I urge the committee to support House File 1215, and I stand with small providers who deliver essential services to vulnerable Minnesotans. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Harut. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1215? Seeing none, public testimony is now closed. Questions from the committee for Representative Clardy or the testifiers? Seeing none, come on. Nothing?
It's fine.
All right, Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think, Representative Clardy, this is a good way of looking into how do we make sure and ensure that we address the needs of the individuals that are being served in a setting, but also with clear guidance and also transparency in how we track and provide support. So I think there's more work to be done, and I appreciate the direction we're going with this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Clardy, final word.
Thank you for considering this bill. Transparency is a key, and we need to make sure that the forms are accessible and just able, that they don't interfere with the work that's supposed to be done. So thanks for your support.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1215, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. That's not a motion. We're just going to lay it over. That concludes our agenda for today. We get to meet again at 8:15 tomorrow morning. And we'll see you then on March 6th. We are adjourned.